I do now, I mean, you know, going back to this thing about the payphones and the, you know, landline phones, I mean, you know, I'm down with that. I mean, I am down with the idea that, you know, it makes sense in that, if you think about it in that way. But, I mean, you know, you do also, you know, you do set up the fact that they have to get to certain exit points.
Right.
And, I mean, you know, maybe you could just do that, except, you know, use the thing like in the cell or use a cell phone. Because,
from a technical standpoint, you know, whether or not, you know, the hard line telephone thing was a good idea, okay, but, you know, it works for me better than a cell phone would, you know, mm-hmm. or I guess the chip thing, again, I mean, you know, this is not a controlled environment, so you have to kind of come from the standpoint, they're just kind of discovering these mm-hmm. exit points. But, you know, I mean, cell phone thing just doesn't work for me, right? Because, I mean, you're trying to send data up and down. The wire works a lot better.
Okay. I mean, you know, and I understand that. Right. I do understand that, but it's like, I don't know. And the thing is, it's like, why do they have to use these kind of phones? Because of the fact that, I mean, this is supposedly sent in 1999. How often do you see these kind of phones around? I mean, how often do you see the dial phones around?
Do they have to use the rotary phone?
They have to use a. I think
it's just a landline.
Yeah, it's just landline.
So I mean, you could have like the push button phone, and I mean, you know, I guess that's something that doesn't really make any sense to me either. It's like, why are they these old phones that nobody's really used consistently?
I think that's just a style.
Yeah, I think
sort of
the
approach. That's the approach. That's the style of the approach. I think to the movie anyway.
I think that may have been a conscious decision.
That's all it is. It's a style choice.
Right. I mean, they're supposed to be replicating the world as we know it in 1999. I mean
those
phones
at least
get
this.
They do exist, but they're not as widespread as they're making it in this movie.
In place. I mean, okay.
Most old style
phones allowed to be in there. You know, and all the payphones seem to be touchpads.
Yeah.
So
that's true. Okay,
I'm with James on that one. I think that's more of just a style choice. I mean, I think mm-hmm. they consciously said, okay, we're going to put this old kind of rotary phone in here and make that just kind of thing. Okay, that just kind of freaks me out when he just kind of jumps on something like that. I mean, I don't know that things you have. I mean, I'm down. You know, all right, cool.
Admittedly, at this point in the movie, I just kind of stopped caring about, you know, Morpheus. I don't know. I just, you know, it's just part of the thing that's like, I just don't feel any attachment to the story. The story just doesn't. This movie just doesn't. It doesn't resonate with me. You know, and I think that's part of the problem with it. I mean, you know. I'm not asking for anything like profoundly emotional, like Titanic or AI or something like that. But I mean, at least give me something emotionally to hang my hat on. I mean,
I think this is a pretty emotional moment right here, where he's like walking around killing people.
Mm-hmm. Well,
the betrayal, and then he's just walking around like killing people so easily. I mean, it's again, coming from the disturbing emotional angle, mm-hmm. which is what I think most of the emotional moments are in this movie.
Well, see, to me, it's all manufactured. I mean, to me, it strikes me all as very manufactured. It's like, oh, we've got to have this just because of the fact that, I mean, you know, well,
it goes
this
back,
is a staple in any movie.
It goes back to whether or not you feel as if the sentimentality in a movie is being forced.
Mm-hmm.
The emotional component in a movie is being forced. It goes back to whether or not you feel that way. And, you know, and I felt, you know, I felt as if, you know, the emotional component in AI was forced, even though, and mm-hmm. I know Brian feels the exact opposite way of that. Brian,
I do.
But, you know.
Well, see, one of the things is, it's like, I've seen this type of scene in other movies
right.
done better,
right,
and more ingeniously.
Right, right, right.
You know,
I'm assuming these guys will get better as they go along.
And you can't kill Keanu Reeves; he's the star.
Right, right.
You know he's not. It's one of those things where it's like, you know, he's not going to die. He's the freaking star of the movie.
Yeah, of course. I mean, yeah, of course.
You know,
yeah,
I mean, yeah, you'd be delusional to think so.
Right, 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 right.
But, you know, you
so
see...
it's like, you know something's going to happen to save him.
Of course. But, I mean, I think that was part of the movie. I mean, I think they planned it.
Yeah.
But, you know, we were talking about the lack of... romantic story, you know, mm-hmm. the first one, which obviously is going to be touched on more in the sequels. But I think it's interesting how maybe you don't feel it consciously throughout the first time you watch it, but the second or third time you watch it again, you start to notice the subconscious.
Mm-hmm.
Idea of Trinity trying to tell Neo throughout the movie that, you know, she's destined to fall in love with the Chosen One,
right.
And you know, you do kind of pick up on that maybe like the second time you watch it, you pick up on her trying to tell him what the Oracle has already told her, and mm-hmm. that she knows that he is, you know, the one, and I think that adds to the mystery.
Yeah, you know, I mean, I think of it kind of from the Harry Potter standpoint when, you know, they start off the story as Harry already being the one. He has no idea how. He has no idea why.
Yeah.
But, you know, he's already the one. And it's drilled into his, through the actions, through stuff happening to him. It's mm-hmm. kind of drilled into your head that he is the one. And then you're kind of just waiting to see, you know, how and why. And, you know,
yeah.
I don't think this movie does it as well as those books do it. But I think it does it well enough, which is kind of throughout the entire movie for me. You know, the story is good enough to carry things along, you know.
I think part of the reason it doesn't, you know, it doesn't work in this movie, and I know why it doesn't work for me in this movie, is because of the fact that, I mean, you know, all of this, you don't have Neo discovering any of this stuff for himself. You always have it being explained to him by somebody else.
Mm-hmm.
That's one of the things I love so much about Dark City is, you know, you have very little interaction between the sort of mentor character played by Kiefer Sutherland and the protagonist played by Rufus Sewell. Rufus Sewell was basically having to find out all of this stuff for himself, and along the way, you have Kiefer Sutherland filling in some of the blanks.
Right. And, but, you know, I think it's just a style thing. You know, I mean... you know, in some stories, you've got the guy, you got the mentor holding the hand of the guy for a long time until he's kind of on his own, and then another, you have the mentor coming along every once in a while to, you know, kind of push him along, like, you mm-hmm. know, Lord of the Rings or something like that. You know, but again, thinking that this is part of a trilogy, you know, he's holding his hand now, but he won't be holding his hand later.
Oh, you know? I'm sure that's the case, but the thing is, it's like, you know, you mentioned Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. In Lord of the Rings, I mean, you know, Gandalf is out of the picture.
Oh, yeah, and that's what I'm
like
saying.
Early on in the movie. And I mean, really, you know, after he explains what the deal is with Frodo, when Frodo takes on that responsibility.
And that's what I'm saying. I was contrasting that with this one. Yeah, that's what I'm saying. And I'm saying that, you know, Neo's responsibility taking on moment hasn't even happened yet.
Mm-hmm.
As far as I'm concerned, that happened right at the end of the movie,
which I think is a problem in the case of the movie because of the fact that I think that maybe I would have gotten felt a little more attached to the characters if they had done that.
I got you.
Having Neo figure this thing out for himself.
I got you.
You know, sort of acting, you know, dealing with the movie as a film noir, as a mystery.
Mm-hmm.
You know, whereas instead the mystery is ruined like not even halfway into the movie, like I said before.
You know, and I think it's just a question of balance. You know, I mean, they were, again, they've got so much to explain. You know, and they've got so many different kind of mysteries to keep mm-hmm. going. That, you know, I mean, they had to make some choices. You know, and this is just the choice that they made.
Why was Why did they wait like 4 or 5? How many years has it been between
4 years?
Yeah. Why did they wait so long to release the?
That's a good question. I think a lot of it had to do with developing the scripts. You know, because I know they were originally dealing with going to do the Animatrix as a cartoon series. As a TV series, as opposed to just an anthology, which is what it is now.
Which they could do with a couple of those. I mean, a couple of just the short sequences they could easily.
Oh yeah.
In the series.
Oh
easily.
Yeah.
That would be. Great
I mean,
series.
Let's put it this way: you could distill like, you could probably go even further in depth into the Second Renaissance.
Oh yeah.
In like a span of a few weeks, several weeks,
oh, yeah.
And
that's
it would probably do
certainly
program. Well. Yeah. I don't know. I mean, programmers, I don't know. I can see, as part of the problem with programming Final Flight of the Osiris, I think, is the fact that it's like both of those are more action-based. And, I mean, I don't think there's necessarily enough story in
those.
I mean,
programming's probably the closest one to this that I've seen yet.
So yeah.
That might be why you don't like it, right?
No, not necessarily.
No,
I mean, I it was hard for me when I first saw it to find the point of program.
Yeah, I mean,
it was basically like, you know, it was just like one of the short training sequence at the beginning.
Yeah, and I think that was part of the point. I mean, you know,
yeah.
I mean they had the guy from Ninja Scroll. I mean, dude, I mean, come on.
Mm.
I mean, if you ever seen Ninja Scroll, I mean, that's hardcore action.
Mm.
And so, I mean, that part of the point was the action sequences in, you know, just coming like that.
Yeah. Detective story, I think, you know, I love detective story because it is very much a film noir. You know, I mean, it's very much inspired by film noir. I mean, you know, detective story, that story,
right.
That the title basically tells you that it is. Mm-hmm. And the director on that was actually, I don't remember how to pronounce his name, but he did Cowboy Bebop.
Okay. Yeah,
so,
yeah,
I mean, you know. I know he's got a couple in there. But, yeah, I really like the story of that. I really liked how they established that story.
And here comes the sort of the machine's point of view.
Yeah.
Of why, how and why things are the way they are. I mean, these guys are coming also from like kind of a. I mean, you can tell these guys are sort of pseudo computer nerds,
mm-hmm.
you know, and they're coming from sort of a technical scientific standpoint right here.
Yeah.
That, and the fact that they're basing it in that, I kind of think makes it a bit more real than, you know, kind of out there fantasy that it could be. so, I mean, again, not perfect, but it works well enough for me to move the story along.
The thing with the natural resources, they're basically explaining that as to basically how mammals work.
Right.
You know, not so much why they need, why they're out to destroy the man.
No, wait,
control
wait,
man, sorry.
Wait, I thought he was saying it like, you know, mammals, all other animals live in symbiosis with their environment, except for us.
Yeah, and that's why he mentions the fact that it's like, that's why he compares them to disease.
Right.
That's why he compares them to disease. Us to diseases because of the fact that we are the only mammal that does that.
Right.
This moment's been parodied recently in car commercials. I don't know if anyone's seen
that.
Yeah.
They did a great parody of this in the last episode of the Clerks animated series.
Uh huh. Yeah.
It's absolutely hysterical,
and probably one of the better parodies is the MTV Movie Awards the year that Sarah Jessica Parker hosted, and they did a sort of a Sex in the City meets The Matrix, which I thought was pretty clever.
Mm-hmm.
Sex in the Matrix, anyway.
Anyway,
that's what
you were asking before why it took 4 years for him to release the ones, and I sort of went off on a tangent about the Animatrix, but I think a lot of it had to, you know, I'm sure a lot of it had to do with, you know, getting the budget in line, and actually budget for the next two movies is pretty enormous, basically the equivalent of what they're paying for all three Lord of the Rings movies. you know, just for two movies. But
well, if you've seen the trailers, you would see why. But
yeah, I mean, there's a lot of action. I mean, they build a 2-mile stretch of highway specifically for their own little playground for car chase, standoff car chases.
I think it'll
I think also art research and development on how to improve upon Bullet Time, because of the fact that it's become so passe.
Did the fact that Aaliyah died?
I think that was actually.
Did that have any effect?
I think that had some effect.
Okay.
Because of the fact that
they had gotten done.
If I remember correctly. Actually, you know what? I've got it from here.
Well, you know,
here we're talking about Matrix Reloaded. And
actors can be replaced so quickly.
Oh, yeah.
I think
some parts that are written specifically for some actors.
Yeah, if I'm not mistaken, she had just done training. They hadn't actually filmed anything with her.
Gotcha.
Or they filmed enough to where it's like, it wasn't enough to where they would have to. They lost a lot of ground because of that.
Yeah. This
now,
is,
see, what's
this,
the point of having
this,
all of these?
This
I
is
mean,
where you're supposed. This is. I mean, this was meant to get a laugh, and that's the kind of the morbid thing about it is that you know.
Yeah, and I mean, you know, you figure that month after this happened, Columbine happened. I mean, you know, I'm one of these people who I think the idea of, you know, a movie or something inspiring a tragedy such as Columbine is absolutely ludicrous, but
by the way, she looks really great in that outfit.
Yeah. I mean, I just, what's the point of having 45 guns?
You know, I mean,
what's the point of it? I mean, this is the last part of this movie.
I think it
seems to be this is where Joel Silver creatively took over. And so,
but I didn't mind that.
I mean, the action, it looks kind of cool.
I'm quite charged by the action. I'm quite, you know, even though it does, when you think about it philosophically, it does seem a little unnecessary, but it's just because, you know, the movie's moved so slowly up until, you know, for such a long time. You know?
Yeah, and that's one of the problems I have with the movie is it really does take too long to...
But I like the balance between the exposition and the action.
As I'm rewatching the movie, if you really listen to the exposition, really listen to what the guys are saying, the balance between the pacing and the balance between the action and the exposition actually really isn't that bad because some of the stuff that they're explaining the exposition is really either disturbing or so deep. That you know, it kind of keeps you captivated through that. If you're really looking at it.
That's exactly how I feel.
Right.
And see, here we have in this action sequence. I mean, this sort of backs up what I say about the slow motion.
That scene right there was nothing but slow motion. Right.
I mean, it really slows down the action to a point where it's not kinetic so much.
You've got the propeller.
Kind of boring.
In the background, keeping it rolling.
The brilliant thing about the way John Woo shoots action with slow motion, and this is the case of his best films, not necessarily MI2, but
that's hideous. Sorry,
but I mean, you have the combination of slow mo and going back to normal speed,
right.
And the fact that I remember reading something about where he finds different speed devises different speeds of slow mo. He uses different speeds of slow motion for different actors. He uses one for Chow Yun-fat, one for Nicolas Cage, one for Tom Cruise, and all that stuff. And so you get a certain degree of variation. Here, I don't think you get it.
Right.
Any variation.
Again, just like everything else in the movie, I think while that was done well, there's obviously guys who are doing it better. And it's just a question of. Balance, and I think these guys will do it better later. It's just again, just the first shot at it. So, but for me, throughout the movie, all the elements, some of the elements that you really don't like, Brian, are good enough to work for me.
Let's see,
Yeah, this is from the Premiere article in this month's Premiere about the Matrix Reload. It's referring to Elias' death. From a purely practical standpoint, Elias' death didn't affect filming greatly because she had been in only a handful of scenes in Alameda. The majority of her work was due to take place when production resumed in Sydney on September 24th.
Gotcha.
So, right there, I mean, no, her death didn't... Let's put it this way. Gloria Foster's death actually had more... you know, and this is horrible to say because of the fact that, you know, Laya dying was a tragedy because she did seem... She was on her way to seem like a promising premiere, her career. But Gloria Foster's actually had more impact on the production.
I can definitely imagine that.
Because of the fact that they basically had to rethink the way they were going to do the rest of the movie. But I know they spent a good deal of time shooting the two movies because they did them back to back.
Right.
It took like a month for some sequences alone.
Oh, well, yeah, we're looking at probably...
Yeah, this is obviously probably the most revolutionary thing in the movie, the idea of the bullet time.
Yes, I mean, of course, they've already showed one pseudo-bullet time-like sequence before this, but this one's probably one of the most...
This is the most imitated one.
Right, exactly. And I mean, you know, I mean, I think that right there really, really brought sort of these guys are trying to do, you know, an anime thing.
Yeah.
Forth. I mean, that is an anime thing right there, the bullet time. If they didn't have that, the style really wouldn't have worked almost for the imitation of the anime.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and I think that's part of the reason, you know, like I said, that's part of the reason they took them so long again to actually do the sequels because of the fact that they wanted to figure out how to do one-up bullet time or ten-up bullet time. Because apparently there's a scene in Reload where you have, like, Neo against 100 Agent Smiths. Mm-hmm. And...
That would take a little while to do, I would think.
Right.
Well, I mean, yeah.
In the theater when I was watching this movie, the scene where she gets loaded with the program to fly the helicopter.
That got a good laugh.
Yeah, that got a good laugh. I mean, you know, it's kind of laugh like, oh God, I can't even believe that was possible. And
then
kind of good laugh is like, oh, you know, that was kind of cool. Uh-huh. So it's kind of both.
See, why are we shooting at them? Because it's not going to kill them in the first place.
Isn't that like a temporary disabling thing? So I mean,
think so.
Yeah.
Yeah,
so, I mean,
because
yeah.
I mean, you saw the guy, you know, morph back into the police officer. But it's like
I'm assuming all
you know
getting
these shots of all the cartridges going off, and it's like,
I mean, I think
we
shots
need all
stupid.
This. I mean, they look good, but I mean, you know,
yeah, I mean,
what's the
see,
point of them?
Whenever you see guns firing, you get the shells coming down effect, you know, just to sort of symbolize again how many bullets he's actually fired. I don't know if this scene really worked for me though. This
breaking really the chains. Is like.
I mean, Lawrence Fishburne is trying, obviously.
It's really... They're laying it on way too thick in this scene.
Thick.
I mean, it's like, did we need to see this in, like,
way
slow motion?
Thick.
Again, too much of a good thing.
That did not
now, the use of bullet time in this scene is cool.
Yeah.
You know, seeing...
Seeing it go
this is...
Go through
a foot. That's cool.
The pacing of this action sequence, I mean, I guess they needed the Morpheus moment to kind of slow it down, because, I mean, you know, they're coming in, shooting people guns, and then you see another fight scene, bullet time, and then, you know. So I guess that was a nice moment to slow it down, and now, you know, we're back on again.
I don't know. I guess I'm sort of like Roger Ebert, because I know he was disappointed that it's like movies start off promising but ended in an action sequence.
Right.
You know,
right.
Like it looks like it's going to be a really deep, intriguing film. Instead, it turns into an action extravaganza.
Right.
Not to say that the action isn't good in this movie, because a lot of it is pretty good, but it's like.
Now, here's a sequence that would not have survived post 9/11, I don't think.
No. I don't think this movie, period, will survive much post 9/11, or at least the last half of this movie.
I mean, it's a really amazing sequence.
Hell, this part wouldn't have lasted post Columbine.
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
But
this wouldn't have survived.
Oh, yeah, this is that's almost kind of.
And I like how
and
of course you have to have the gratuitous hero in front of the ball of flames and all that stuff. And
I'm down with it.
I'm down with it. I mean, again,
I've seen
it done
the action
40
I'm,
million times before.
I'm feeling,
and you're gonna see it done another 40 million times.
Another 40 by time by.
And then the heroic music coming in. And,
again.
But
yeah,
it's
gonna suck because
I'm right there
times.
With it though.
Yeah.
But you know, I mean, are you right there with it? I mean, are you in it? Okay, well then fine. That's the whole point.
Meh. By this time, I wasn't really into it. First time I saw it, I'm still kind of not. I mean, because it's like, again, we have this whole idea. It's like, okay, he's the one. I figured this out. An hour and a half ago.
Well, yeah, because she gave him.
He's the main character of the story. He's got to be the one.
Right.
It's like
again.
And do you even? I mean, I don't know. I'm seeing it work.
I mean, again, I just. But I think about that. I'm just thinking about Harry Potter. You know.
Yeah.
Yeah. Okay. You're told straight off from the bat that obviously he's the one that's going to have to, you know, come back and fight Voldemort, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Mm-hmm.
He is the one. Okay, but you know, we still, but still, the whole story is about the evolution of that. How does that happen? I mean, yeah.
And see that just, I mean, you know, that and that really just intrigued me. That story gets me much more than this one does. I mean, this story just doesn't really, you know, I mean, just because of the fact that you've got all these special effects and all that stuff. I mean, you know, just because of the fact that it's like. Hey, wow, look what we can do. It's like, you know, don't forget emotion. I mean, you know, it's something we've talked about certainly on Spider-Man as well as some of our other commentaries. I mean, you know, don't forget about it.
Yeah, and
you know, and they try to do it, and, you know, like we've said,
well,
I mean, we're going to have to wait until Reload and Revolution to see where the Neo Trinity thing goes.
Right.
But in this movie,
the emotional component.
Without Revolution, I mean, you know, you really.
Yeah.
I don't care how well you follow it up. The original should always be able to stand on its own emotionally,
mm-hmm.
and in terms of story. And this one, because of the fact that you have to wait and see how it progresses, it just doesn't work out.
Yeah, and I still just come back to a question of balance. You know, and I think the emotional part is just a little bit more subtle,
mm-hmm.
but it's still there. But, you know, I mean, if they had tried to explore the love story between him and Trinity now, how much would we have missed out on, you know? I just don't know. I mean,
it is saving more for the...
The thing is, though, I mean, it's like, I'm not saying that they should be absolutely in love
right.
by the end of this movie. I mean, at least show me that there's an interest on both sides.
Yeah,
you know,
and there's
a start to this because of the fact that for most of the movie, it's just not there.
Right.
You know, you get in the last 20 minutes of the movie.
Right. Which is where I think they planned on you getting it.
That's where they wanted you to get.
This is
fun. It's sort of reminiscent of old Western.
Yeah, you can
and it's kind of a fun little moment.
dodging bullets.
I think this was the sequence where after Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, it just didn't impress me in the least.
Yeah, I feel that.
I mean, you know, it just really fell flat for me after. I mean, I know it's the same choreographer, and, I mean, he's a genius.
Right.
You know, he's an absolute genius. I can't wait to see what he does with not just Reload and Revolutions, but what he does in Tarantino's new film, because I've seen the teaser for that several times, and it's absolutely brilliant, some of what happens. Mm-hmm. But, and the potential is there, but...
I mean, and I think... I think he had slightly better...
I would enjoy watching you die.
Crouching Tiger, Hidden Dragon, he had some slightly better martial artists.
Yeah.
To deal with, obviously, to these guys.
I mean, you know, that not to knock what these guys did.
Oh, yeah, no, I mean...
They went through months of training, and they went through months of training on Reload and Revolutions, too.
Yeah.
But, I don't know, part of the thing I have is, you know, Ang Lee very rarely in that movie uses slow motion.
Right.
And slow motion, you know, if it's not utilized properly, can really kill an action sequence. And in some of the cases, I think here they kind of do it.
Right. I feel that. I feel that. I'm just coming from, again, the anime standpoint. That's how I explain why they use it so much.
Oh, yeah. And, I mean, you know, I understand that. I mean, this is, like I said earlier, this is the first real live-action anime, even though I know they've done remakes of anime movies in live-action,
mm-hmm.
and they've been talking around for years about live-action Akira, which, I just can't contemplate what that's like.
I don't want to either. That'd be difficult.
But especially that last part, I mean, you just couldn't do it in live action without spending hundreds of millions of dollars. You'd have to guarantee a hit.
A live action Cowboy Bebop, though, I don't know if I mind it.
Well, they've got the Cowboy Bebop movie coming out. Yeah.
I know that.
Well, it's an anime. It's obviously an animated movie.
I know they have Knockin' at Heaven's Door.
Well, Joss Whedon's Firefly is sort of a live-action Cowboy Bebop.
Okay.
It's coming out on DVD, I think, sometime later this year, because the show was canceled so quickly by Fox.
Yeah.
But that was very much like Cowboy Bebop. I don't know, some might argue. It's not as good as Cowboy Bebop, but it's still fun. One thing I've begun to notice, at least in this season of Angel, what's going on, they've really absorbed the style of The Matrix. They've used a lot of slow motion, a lot of sort of...
Ooh, Charisma Carpenter in slow motion?
Not necessarily, but in the action sequences, they've really utilized a lot of sort of Matrix-inspired moments, and then actually episodes in season 4 of Buffy, they did that too.
So no Charisma Carpenter in slow motion on Angel.
I'd have to get back to you on that one, but
all right.
That we're hoping.
But
anyway, they've really dealt with the whole life, and they've really started their own sort of idea on Angel, you know, the truth being covered. No, what is the quote from the movie? World pulled over your eyes to blind you from the truth. They've really sort of taken that to heart the past couple of episodes of Angel, in an arc that's really been quite surprising.
And now we have sort of a double suspense action with Jim being in danger in the real world and also Neo being in danger in the Matrix. And then, I didn't mind that parallelism, you know, one having to, you know, in order to make it work, one having to get to the other. These sort of montage of shots, I think, went a bit overboard. I mean, you know, I think they're trying to get the effect that, you know, I mean, he can appear anywhere, whatever, and, you know, again, trying to heighten the suspense, but I think it went off.
Well, they established that before.
It works
in this context. I don't have any problem with that. I think it's a good conceit. you know, me, the idea that they can turn up at any point.
It just goes on a little really, too long.
I think it works in this sequence, I think, because of the fact that it's like, you don't know how much, you know. There's a certain degree of suspense, I'll admit.
The guy who's pushing this along, and I guess this is the point, is Keanu Reeves.
Yeah.
You know, I mean, he is pushing this along. But the guy's appearing, you know, and trying to kill him, I don't think that's pushing it along as much as Neo is.
Another sequence that does kind of leave me...
I like
that. Another sequence does kind of leave me breathless.
One of the most disturbing ones.
Mm-hmm. This is a pretty good chase sequence, although it does have a little too much shaky cinematography. I mean,
well, I like
you know. I understand sort of a handheld look in some movies, but it's like
I like the
some action sequences. It just doesn't work at all.
I like the point of view of you know, Neo, and that kind of I really do feel as if that builds the suspense.
Yeah.
Well, see,
the handheld is supposed to represent Neo's point of view.
Right.
Yeah, but the big problem is when you see Neo in the frame, and you know it's not from his point of view,
and it's still shaky.
That's a big problem. You know, it's like, okay, did we not have a dolly on set this day or whatever they use?
I mean, obviously, that was a conscious choice. I just wouldn't know why they decided to do that.
Yeah.
But here it is again. You know, and I guess, I mean, he's running there. I guess that kind of works. I mean, I guess
it's sort of a real time thing. You know, you sort of get the sense that it's like.
And you notice that it's always with Neo. It's never with those guys. It's never with the agency. Yeah, Ron, I feel you.
Yeah, but anyway, I mean, you know, my complaints about the shaky cam in this area, I mean, in no way meant to disparage against what else Bill Pope does in this movie, because there are some spectacular visuals, at least from a cinematography standpoint in this movie.
Big gasp scene that's about to come up right here.
Yeah.
And you're just like, you know, when he dies, you're just like, okay. You know, I thought that was a good thing.
Well, he can't die. Right. He's the one.
Is he, though?
Is he? He's
died. We've only heard it 15 times.
I counted
11 times where the one is at least hinted at. Or the chosen one, or something like that.
When you're in the movie, you know, and it comes, when you see the movie for the first time, and it comes to this point, you're like, you know, what the hell? I mean, you're not thinking about the fact that the Oracle did explain to him that, you know, you're waiting for a second life, what have you, in order for it to come out.
No, you're just very caught up in the moment.
Yeah, you're just like, okay, how did he just die? He is, you know, I mean, they've been drilling the one hero into your brain throughout the entire movie. How did he just die? So from that standpoint, I like how that works.
Oh, absolutely.
I will say I do like how the agents have this sort of nondescript look at them. I mean, they, you know, they just sort of all look alike,
right,
which is something Morpheus says when in the confrontation scene.
It's kind of a...
Yeah.
And then you have the girl talking to the guy.
Yeah.
Surviving him. Okay, I'm down.
I think I heard Carrie Ann Moss mention that she really enjoyed the fact that her part was very strong, but at the same time very feminine.
Right.
And very... the female point of view of her character was not lost. And I feel that.
Yeah, I feel that too. I feel that too.
She, you know, she's a very strong character, but at the same time, she's very much a
good-looking girl.
Kind of the tomboy that everyone gets a crush on. All the guys get a crush on.
I'll admit, I mean, this movie does get more watchable the more you watch it. I mean, I think, you know. I mean, my opinion of this movie has really improved with through watching it again.
I don't know. Does he still have the bullets in him? Because I mean, that was pretty much,
I don't know.
But that was the first scene where he, as Morpheus was saying at the beginning, he doesn't have to dodge bullets.
Yeah. You know,
you
won't have to.
You won't have to.
Right. And this is, I kind of like this little, yeah, he picks the bullet out of there and then moves his head, you know, to the right and then, yeah, to the left and then, you know, makes them all fall down. I think that was pretty good.
Actually, it's to the left, I think.
Yeah, I said to the left, second.
See, he is the one.
And this, yeah, that shot of the Matrix right there, I thought that was
that's pretty cool.
I mean, they didn't have to do that.
Yeah.
But then putting that in there really kind of makes it work.
In the helm, I guess. This is another good laugh right here.
Yeah.
I enjoyed very much sitting in a movie and listening to people cheer watching a movie with a big crowd, and I got the opportunity to do this.
That's the only part of the scene that didn't work for me right there. The legs stick out. What the heck was that?
Yeah.
Why did that happen? I mean, come on. It's like Keanu Reeves' cheesiness coming through you. That was pretty freaky.
That is pretty surreal in a way.
Some interesting Peter Graffs going on right there.
Yeah.
Well, I'm going to be interested, you know, because they pretty much convey the fact that Agent Smith has been destroyed here, and I'm going to be interested in seeing how he's brought back for for the sequels. That's going to be an interesting.
Well, he sort of hinted in the trailer for Reloaded.
Mm-hmm.
You know. But it'll be interesting to see what the real explanation for it.
Because, you know, hopefully...
Get your ass back here.
Yeah, that's the scene that kind of, like, leaves me out of breath.
And I like that decision right there, not to show him running to the phone, but to just show the camera going to the phone.
This was pretty romantic right here. This has some potential here.
You know, and we're just movie's just beginning. You know,
we're just breaking the surface here.
Yeah. I mean, we're just kind of getting started. And I like how they. You know, if
here we have blatant sequel set up.
Yeah, I mean, if you look at the what the numbers what was actually being said on the screen, it actually almost makes sense. I thought that was a nice touch. I mean, it didn't have to really make it make sense, but it actually made sense. Carrier anomaly and stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
That kind of brings me along with the idea of the modem thing. Just those words right there.
Better exposition for a sequel than another recent movie franchise that's meant to be a trilogy. I think this is a better exposition for sequel than X-Men, actually.
It's certainly better than Daredevil.
Well, is Daredevil meant to be a franchise?
It's a big superhero movie.
So any superhero movie can be made into franchise.
Here's
one thing I don't get. What's with the flying? What's the point of the flying?
Kick-ass ending, I guess.
I mean, it's just one of the... Here, let's show this off. Let's show off what he can do. I mean, you know, is there any real point to it? I mean, you know, we know that, you know, he's figured out that, you know, the laws of gravity don't really apply.
Right.
If you believe that, but is there a point?
I think the writers and the directors wanted a flying superhero, but they didn't want Superman.
Right.
Yeah.
Oh,
but
that,
see,
yeah.
I mean, that's sort of, you know, to me that just doesn't work, flying away. I mean, just have him walking away.
Yeah,
that would have worked for me. I mean, you have him, talking on the phone to somebody and all that stuff. You have him walking away looking all cool and stuff like that. I mean, he's by that point, he's the epitome of cool.
For me,
so
I mean, and I'm down with that idea, but for me, I think it would set it up. I think it kind of sets up some of the suspense for the sequels. Okay, wow, how is he just blind?
Mm-hmm.
So I want to know how that's going to happen. And I mean, obviously, in the second one, when the show scenes,
I mean,
in the trailer,
well, I understand why he's flying.
Yeah, you know,
I understand the reasoning within the film as to why he's flying.
Right.
I mean, he's accepted the fact that it's like, I mean, laws of gravity. Okay. Gone, right. Out the window.
Mm.
But is there a point to it that we're going to? I mean, I don't know. It sort of goes back into this idea of motive. What's the motivation for him flying away? Is there a point to it within the story that?
And for me,
I mean,
I don't know.
I'm trying to figure out way too long. Thinking about it way too logically, but
yeah,
the fact of the matter is
that's
how I'm thinking about it.
I think meant purely for the audience.
Oh yeah,
purely for the audience.
No, there was no other reason.
We're gonna have more of them in Reloaded.
What do you mean?
There are a couple of scenes in the trailer where you see him flying through. It's like, okay,
are we going
to establish why this is something that's important?
And they may, but I think they really did want a superhero that flies, but they didn't want Superman.
Yeah.
You know, I think that's just it. You know, I mean, and flying, it's just one of the additional ways that he can manipulate his environment, which he's supposed to do. That's all part of the point. That's all part of why, for me. But I just want to mention that the beginning of Rage Against the Machine, which is like number 7 off one of their discs. I mean, this really kind of got me interested again in Rage Against the Machine. That song right there.
Hmm.
Which, I mean, I'm not really interested in anymore because they're kind of a hardcore group and they broke up. But that is a pretty sweet song.
Yeah. A couple of things I wanted to mention about some of the credits we saw here in the end credits. Barry Osborne, who I believe is one of the executive producers on this film, is one of the producers on Lord of the Rings trilogy. And Andrew Mason, unless this is a different one, I don't think it is, also produced Dark City. So, if this is the same one, I assume it is. So, little tidbits there.
Mm-hmm. I'm about to see Dark City, right? I don't think I've seen that before.
Yeah, check out Dark City. Check out the commentaries, too, especially one by Roger Ebert, because he loved the movie.
Mm-hmm.
Put it number one as top 10 for 98, and you know, I feel very much the same way he does about it. As in case you can't tell. Final thoughts, Ron?
I've just enjoyed listening to you guys go back and forth. I think good points on both sides. I'm not as fanatic about this film as I am you guys. I mean, I'm just sitting back and enjoying the film. It's not necessarily a film, but like just a movie, just something just a popcorn flick that I think does have more heart and brains to it than perhaps maybe Brian thinks. I think there is a lot more brains to it than Brian thinks, and I'm able to appreciate that. I'm also able to appreciate Brian's, you know, arguments that he makes. I'm able to appreciate that, and I'm able to appreciate what Dave has to say in defense to them. And I think good points on both ends. And I'm genuinely sorry I wasn't able to add more of my two cents in there. But again, I was just enjoying the movie, and I was enjoying the conversation. And good points on both ends. And kudos to both of you, and props to both of you, and I look forward to going to see the sequels with you guys and hearing more discussions because, you know, I'm just not that smart. But anyway.
For me, it's not quite the I like the movie so much and now I'm arguing the points. Mine is coming from I can see the anime influence
and I really like anime. You know, I can see sort of the storytelling, sci-fi storytelling. You know, and I love the science fiction, fantasy storytelling, all those elements of the story, and I can see them being brought together, and I can appreciate it from that standpoint. And you know, so some of the things from a logical standpoint that may not work, I'm still feeling because I'm looking at it from there. You know, and again, for animes that have sequels or series, you know, you're not going to get everything in the first movie, and so you know I'm looking at it from that standpoint too.
Yeah.
But overall, I do like the movie, and I think for Haynes, just going back to what you say, for if this was just going to be seen as a popcorn flick, it definitely contains more heart, more intelligence than your normal popcorn flick would. I would think, but that's just me.
Right. Okay. And I'm going to try to wrap it up as quickly as I can. Well, I mean, you know, I've said about the heart. I don't think there's enough of it in this movie. As far as intelligence, it's not that I don't think it's completely... It's not that I think it's completely devoid of intelligence. It's not necessarily a dumb movie in that... Like, just a dumb movie. I mean, it's
right.
It's more intelligent than your typical popcorn flick. This is true. My problem is, you know, I've seen enough science fiction... cinema and what have you, to where it's like, I know that this type of story can be done much more intelligently, where it can go further in exploring the themes that tries to establish in the first few minutes, and it I don't think it goes far enough in establishing those themes and exploring those themes.
Would you like to plug Dark City one more time, Brian?
I'm going to plug Dark City one more time. Alex Proyas's film. It's his second film. It was made in 1998. Exquisite film, beautiful film. I can't recommend it enough. It's one of my favorite films, as I mentioned. Also, some other movies to check out along these lines. Ridley Scott's Blade Runner, Fritz Lang's original silent film Metropolis, as well as the anima Metropolis, directed by Rintaro, that came out last year. David Cronenberg's Existenz, Ghost in the Shell, another great anima film. Verhoeven's Total Recall, and...
The list goes on.
The list can go on. I'm trying to...
Unfortunately, this commentary cannot.
Terry Gilliam's 12 Monkeys, 13th Floor, all that stuff. Anyway, this is Brian Scuttle.
And Ronnie Haynes.
Dave Moff.
And this is Yahoo's with Microphone. Sorry we went on. I went on so long. And hope to hear, talk to you again on another...